This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Deep South Dining is the show all about the culture of Southern flavor. From fried chicken and collard greens to shrimp and grits and a glass of sweet tea. Subscribe now to the podcast using any podcast app or download our MPB public media app.
From MPB Think Radio, you're listening to Creature Comforts. It's the show all about your animals and the animals around you. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major, veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson. Today on the show, we're going to welcome back Emma Rhodes, co-founder and director of conservation and scientific research at the Banding Coalition of the Americas. She's been on the show in previous summers to tell us about her experiences in bird banding, but today she joins us to give an update during the spring season. Also, Dr. Major is always ready to handle your pet questions. So join the conversation with a question or a comment. Email the show by sending it to animals@mpbonline.org. And always like to remind you that if you miss Creature Comforts on Thursday, it repeats every Saturday morning at 6. So good morning. We'll check in first with Libby, who, Libby, you're back out on the West Coast visiting, I believe. Is that correct?
I am.
So what have you been seeing out there recently?
Well, let's see. The most abundant bird in my yard here is dark-eyed juncos. They're year-round residents here, so nobody else is impressed with them. In Mississippi, we have them in the winter, and we have a good many of them in Mississippi when we're home, too, but it's fun to come up here and hear that whistle again. They have kind of a high-pitched whistle, but, you know, I think what I'm enjoying the most is I like to see things that I don't get to see when I'm at home, and a varied thrush has been coming to our yard fairly often, and I've even got a good picture of it. I'll put it up on Facebook when I get a chance. But they have, I mean, sometimes it sounds like a police whistle. They have a very loud whistle, so you don't miss them. We never get them in Mississippi, so it's kind of fun to see them and hear them out here. So I'm enjoying that. And golden crowned sparrows, that's another thing that I'm not going to see in Mississippi, and I've had a good many of those. And that's another whistle. It's got a more melodic, beautiful whistle compared to the varied thrush, but it's been fun to see. And our Anna's hummingbirds are here all winter, which is just a delight. They're year-round residents here, but winter is when I feel like they need us the most. So I've got the feeders out, and we're getting to see them. But it's always fun to come home to Mississippi, and I'll be back in a couple of 3 weeks. But it's fun to be out here as well and get to see something different.
So, you know, I like to talk about birds and how they got their name. So the dark-eyed juncos, don't all birds kind of have dark eyes?
I guess so. The thing, a junco, the males particularly have a very dark, a black cap over their head, kind of a hood, and you really can't notice their eyes very much. So maybe that's why that was noticeable. I don't know. Who knows why it got picked, but a dark-eyed junco is what it is. And now my assumption, and we have Emma here who's more of an expert, definitely. And it's possible that there are other juncos that don't have dark eyes. That's what I thought. It was probably the reason why these are called dark-eyed juncos. But I don't know about that.
All right. And then the other one that's interesting to me, varied thrush, right? V-A-R-I-E-D, varied.
Yeah. And I don't know why that either. I'm going to have to start doing some research on that. Obviously, Kevin, you always got a question about those names. And that is an unusual name. But they're varied is used in more birds than just this thrush. So I'm not sure why he's a varied thrush either. If Emma wants to weigh in on any of those, we can get that from her.
And then the other one that makes to me the most sense, I think it was the sparrow, the golden, what was it again?
Golden crown.
Right. So they must have a bright gold crown on their head or feathers.
It's not the first thing you notice for sure, but it is a pretty feature when you see it. It's and now these may not be in full breeding. What I saw was an immature, but I've seen others that I guess, well, I've seen the adults here too, but the full males probably have a golder crown than what I'm seeing right now, is what I assume anyway.
You know, I have fortunate in that I mentioned, I think, a time or two, there's a park in Pearl that I'd like to walk at for exercise. And I know I've heard a lot of the frogs that we talk about. And I think, Libby, I sent the picture or posted it on Facebook. I saw, was it a red-tailed hawk the other day? And I think I've also seen, I didn't get a picture, but there was an owl there once. So it's amazing to me. And I think one of the great things about living in Mississippi is, you know, we're here in the suburbs, and yet we're able to get an up-close view of some of the wildlife.
Yes, definitely. Oh, and I enjoyed seeing your red-tailed hawk. That's a beautiful pattern. You know, they vary so much in how they look in their plumage, I guess you'd call it. But the I love that picture you took, because it's pretty much a pale, you know, breast on the bird, and then he's got that almost like a constellation of stars that sweeps across the chest there of the little speckles. I think that's interesting. To me, it looks very astronomical.
So we've had sort of an early, it's been an interesting weather pattern here the last several weeks. You know, it's been some nice, great spring weather followed by back to cold weather again. We humans don't do real well adjusting to the weather. We'd like to complain, I guess, when it varies like that. But what about maybe birds or some of the other creatures around?
Yeah, that can be hard on lots of things. What I always call a false spring. Mm-hmm. And we all get excited, and birds get excited, I guess, too. Reptiles do poorly in that kind of a situation. If you have several warm days and they emerge from wherever they've been holding out for the winter and kind of sleeping the time away, if they come out and eat and then it gets cold again, that's a real problem for their digestive system. And there's not been a whole lot of research about early springs from what I could tell, but one thing that I know I have read, that reptiles and amphibians, all that little bit of stress of that cold weather when it's unexpected, and then hot, you know, or warm weather when it's unexpected, and then cold weather to follow it quickly, is very hard on their bodies, and they seem to be more susceptible to disease, particularly fungal diseases in reptiles. And that can be deadly to them. So it is a problem. And I don't know if that would translate into animals that are able to regulate their body heat like birds and mammals, but it's certainly stressful. The big thing that you think about when spring happens and birds start mating, and that takes a whole lot of energy, of course, to make a nest and to lay eggs for the female is extremely stressful. And if that first nest is lost and they all have to do it again, some birds are pretty prepared to have multiple nestings and multiple clutches of eggs, and it may not matter as much, but some things are not. Generally speaking, our resident birds that are there all winter do a little bit better in times like that, when you have the early spring that gets warm and then you've got cold weather to follow it right away. They, I guess because they kind of see it coming, so at least they get a little bit of that deal. But the big thing is they've got to have their food sources. And with most, well, with all animals, that's plants, and it starts with insects. And so if the insects have not been triggered to come out early, but birds are mating early and maybe laying eggs early, once they've laid those eggs, that's a giant commitment. You know, they got to go through with it, even if it's a little too early and it's cold. So they've got to be able to find food, or that nest is not going to be successful. So that's a sad part about it. And you know, of course, there's always been some kind of early spring's happening, so some things I'm sure adjusted to it better than others. But it remains a stress factor, even for animals that can adapt to it.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. Before we go to our first break, we want to just bring in Dr. Major into the conversation. He joins us each week from his clinic in Jackson. So, Dr. Major, just an interesting question. What kind of give us a look behind sort of a typical day at the clinic? Is it usually kind of regularly scheduled pets coming in for their annual visits and shots and that sort of thing? Or is it I've got a problem, my pet is injured, or maybe is there a good mix of both?
You know, that's a great question. A lot of times it would seem like we're an ER room at the hospital. But there are regularly scheduled appointments. Some things are getting their vaccinations. Some dogs or cats are getting their vaccinations. Others are having a general health checkup. There may be a lump or a bump that the owner has seen that needs to be checked out. And this time of year, well, really year-round, we are seeing the skin problems associated sometimes with allergies, but oftentimes other problems as well with the skin. So that's kind of a year-round thing, but I know some of the dogs that are coming in now, the black ones especially, they look kind of like the cars, you know, that have pollen on them, and I'm sure that's probably aggravating to the owner, but a lot of times a good bath or rub down will help remove that pollen off of their coat. But and remember that our dogs and cats, being on the ground, are a lot closer to some of the allergens that they might come in contact with there. But yes, typical day. There's always an emergency. Not always, but I'd say 90% of the time, there's some sort of an emergency that comes in. So you have to allow for that and take care of that.
Dr. Major will remain on the line, ready for your pet questions throughout the hour. We welcome our guest for this week. It's Emma Rhodes with the Banding Coalition of the Americas. Or you can always email the show as well. Just send it to animals@mpbonline.org. You're listening to Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major and Libby Hartfield. If you're going to join our conversation this morning with your questions or your comments, or you can email the show, send it to animals@mpbonline.org. So we'll welcome into the show our guest for the hour. It's Emma Rhodes. She is co-founder and director of conservation and scientific research for the Banding Coalition of the Americas. Emma, thanks for joining us again on the show. And I'm going to put you on the spot maybe just a bit here to begin. In the first part of the show, Libby and I were talking about a couple of birds and wondering how they might have gotten their name. Any insights into the dark-eyed juncos or the varied thrushes?
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Kevin. I'm happy to be here. I was actually planning to meet your curiosity on those because for the dark-eyed juncos and the juncos, Libby was right about thinking that it has to do with different eye colors. So not all birds have totally dark eyes. Many birds will have different color irises. And for juncos, that is why they have these different names. So dark-eyed junco has a dark iris, but there's something called the yellow-eyed junco that actually has a yellow iris, and it looks quite different because the eye pops out. And so that's why it has those differentiating names. For the varied thrush, to my knowledge, varied just means, simply put, like splotchy or spotted, because when you look at a varied thrush, it sort of has just these different colors and different spots and spotted and splotched colors like orange and gray. And the interesting thing about it, though, is its scientific name, I'll give you this bonus one, Isereus navius, actually means spotted mistletoe berry eating mountain bird.
That's so quite a mouthful.
you got your curiosity met on the for the bird names today.
Well, thank you. That's a peculiarity of mine, but every time I hear the birds' names, and I think my favorite example is the lesser tern. It's like, that's not, you know, you're a lesser one. I would hate to be stuck with that for my life, but it is interesting how they got the names, and the two explanations you gave make absolute perfect sense, so we really do appreciate that.
Yeah, they don't always make sense. I'm just kidding.
So we've had you on during the summertime before, but this is sort of a completely different stage in the life cycle for some of the birds. If you would maybe talk about some of the differences between what people might be seeing from birds in the summertime versus the early spring.
Yeah, so right now we have our early migrants arriving to the Gulf Coast. Things like our purple martins are actually, they've been here for a while. We still have some individuals that are just now arriving. So right now you have a mix of where birds are just starting to migrate and some birds have already returned. We still have a few wintering migrants around. Things like maybe white-throated sparrows haven't started dispersing yet, but they're going to, as we keep getting into March and April, our wintering migratory birds are going to continue northward to their breeding grounds, and we're going to continue to see this uptick of migrants coming to the Gulf Coast, particularly around the first and second week of April when we get all our migrant warblers and buntings and tanagers. And so on top of that, you have our species that breed on the Gulf Coast also simultaneously setting up for breeding. And so we're having both of those co-occurring.
This is Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We're visiting today with Emma Rhodes, the co-founder and director of conservation and scientific research for the Banding Coalition of the Americas. We're going to be talking about purple martins, but I think Emma might be able to help you if you have any sort of bird question this morning. Dr. Major is ready for any pet questions, and we always like to hear about any wildlife experiences. So, Emma, tell us a little about the work that the Banding Coalition of the Americas does.
So we are a nonprofit 501c3 organization, and we're all volunteer, and we're based out of coastal Alabama, so a little town called Foley, Alabama in Baldwin County. And essentially what we do is we're a network of banders that collect vital information through bird banding and different tracking technologies to understand the whole life cycles of birds. But more also as equally as important is outreach for us. So we combine our efforts with banding and outreach. And so we do a lot of public bird banding events because we think that's just as important for people to understand why we study migratory birds and why we need to conserve them in their habitats.
So if you would talk about the purpose and some of the benefits of banding birds.
Yeah, so banding's been around in North America in official capacity for over 100 years or around 100 years. And essentially, you know, it has what has initially given us all this tremendous information about the life histories of birds. Because before a bird is banded, it's not an individual. We don't know that story of that bird. But once we mark a bird and it has a unique identifier, we can start to look at longevity. We can look at survival. You know, is that bird breeding well in its habitat? We can look at migratory routes and start to identify different areas that we need to conserve for population management. And so it gives us this vast amount of data by marking an individual and knowing who that individual is years later.
So has banding technology advanced? Is it do you actually have to re-catch the bird and look at a serial number on the band, or is technology helping out in that area?
Well, technology is helping. Banding is still the cheapest way and the most efficient way to get baseline marking and survey numbers of birds, but you still have to either recapture that bird or what we call resite it. And that can be really difficult with a bird that has a band with 9 digits on its leg. But sometimes we can add field readables, which we do to like our purple martins, where someone would more readily notice a color band, for instance, on a leg, and then they can report it the band that way. But technology is slowly catching up to the technological advances of today. The thing you have to think about is that we're catching up to the technology because it's not necessarily, you know, a moneymaker, right? Wildlife technology and tracking, but we've been able to incorporate these new technologies to better census birds, to better monitor them, in addition to banding. And it can be quite powerful when we combine those tools.
You're listening to Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. We'll visit with Emma throughout the hour. We do, however, have a pet question on the line. So Dr. Major, as I said, visits with us from his clinic in Jackson. So we say good morning to Catherine in Columbus with her question. Go ahead. You're on the air with us.
Yes, Dr. Major, I have a cat that got outside last night. I know it's not a good idea to have your cats go outside, but this one did and got into some oil. And came back dripping with oil. I don't know how he happened to do it, but I immediately tried to wash him off with soap and suds and shampoo and everything, and it still wasn't coming off, so I tried paint thinner, and that seemed to dissolve the oil to some degree, but he's still sticky this morning, and I was wondering if you have any solutions for that.
You know, repeated baths are probably going to be necessary. I'd be careful with the paint thinner. Sometimes it can be irritating. I was thinking about, you know, not a commercial, but Dawn is used in a lot of situations to help break that up. There are different types of commercially available solvents that can be used. I can remember one. I can't think of the name. That Amway used to make was a solvent that helped in situations like this. How does the cat act? Is he acting okay, other than being mad at you for bathing him?
Actually, he handled the washing fairly well. I was surprised. But he's eating well, and he seems to be fairly normal for a cat. So anyway, I'm happy with that.
I would say several bathings with a detergent, maybe not all at once, and then I would use some type of conditioner after you've finished, just to kind of put a little life back into his coat. Has he been vomiting or anything like that?
No, I haven't. I haven't seen him licking himself. I was worried if he was going to start licking, but
yes.
He didn't seem to lick it.
In your opinion, was it more like cooking oil or motor oil?
No, I think it's some kind of motor oil. It was very thick,
okay.
And it was just really hard to break down. I think somebody must have dunked some oil somewhere in a ditch, and he got in it.
I understand that. So good luck with that. As long as he's not showing any neurological signs or any signs of what I would say toxicity, weakness, vomiting, I think you're doing the right thing. Certainly, if he shows any of those other signs, I would get him into your veterinarian, okay? We appreciate
all right, thank
your call,
you so much.
And best of luck. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, Catherine, thanks for your call. Let's go ahead and take another break. When we get back, we'll continue visiting with our guest, Emma Rhodes, with the Banding Coalition of the Americas. And also, we've got Keanu from Vicksburg on the line, ready for some questions. You can email the show by sending it to animals@mpbonline.org. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major, veterinarian at the Animal Medical Center in Jackson, and Libby Hartfield, retired director of the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science. It's Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. And our guest for the hour is Emma Rhodes with the Banding Coalition of the Americas. If you missed any of today's show, you can always subscribe to the podcast using any podcasting app, or you can download the MPB Public Media app for your smartphone. Then you get to listen to all the local MPB Think Radio programs on your schedule. Send an email to animals@mpbonline.org. We do have a caller on the line. So Keanu from Vicksburg, thanks for holding, but you're on the air with us now, so go ahead.
Good morning. I always enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I have two questions. The first one, I had a big difference this winter. Normally, we have a large number of grackles. I didn't see the flocks this winter. I felt very strange. That's one question. And the second one is about the frog. I have a small pond in the backyard, and we used to hear the tree frog or spring peeper. We hadn't heard the singing for many years, and this spring they showed up. I wonder why all of a sudden they came back.
Emma, do you have any thoughts on the grackles?
Yeah, so many blackbird species, including grackles in the winter, are very, I would say, like nomadic in that they move around in really large, like quite large flocks. And it could have to do with weather. It could have to do with local resources. Maybe something changed and they're foraging nearby, but not in your yard. And so it's really hard to say because usually they move around. I would recommend, you know, if you would like to get them back in your yard, you can offer them, you know, maybe some like cracked corn or something like that, or bird seed to attract more birds to your yard and try to get the blackbirds back, because usually that will sort of encourage blackbird and grackle flocks to your yard in the winter. So you might can try that. And they may just, you know, it could just be variable from year to year. So you might see that next year, maybe food resources near you are doing better next year, and they will just naturally travel to your yard. And so that's probably what's going on with the grackles.
And Libby, I would imagine maybe somewhat of a similar situation with the frogs.
Yeah, the spring peepers, I'm glad she's got them again. They're pretty much all about water of just the right depth. They need what we call ephemeral water. Water that's not there year-round tends to be the best for a lot of frog species, because they don't want to be gobbled up, and they don't want their little tadpoles to be gobbled up by fish. And so it's better to have a place that's temporary water so that there are not so many predators around for them.
All right, Keanu, thanks for your call, and thanks for the nice comments about our show. We appreciate you listening and also calling in. Got some calls to get to, but first, a little bit of a discussion with our guest, Emma Rhodes, about purple martins. So, Emma, for those of us who might not be familiar with purple martins, give us an idea of kind of what they look like, where they can be found, and maybe what their diet is.
Yeah, so they're about robin sized, but they have really long wings. They have like a fan tail, and then also they have this like black kind of almost flat bill, but they are this shimmery bluish gray color. The males are very, especially adult males, are stark blue with black wings. And the females have more like a white belly and a lot more gray. And they are aerial insectivores. And so they eat insects on the wing. And they're actually found, so the eastern race is found in Mississippi and throughout the eastern United States. And they're just now starting to set up for their summer breeding season.
Are there some current threats to purple martins?
Yes, so they're migratory. And so all migratory birds are kind of having a rough go at it at the moment. So there's a lot of different factors, habitat loss, both in North America where they breed, as well as South America where they winter. You know, we have things like window strikes, as well as invasive predators that also threaten them. But with martins, especially the eastern race, more critically on their breeding grounds in North America, the problem is a loss of available breeding habitat. And that breeding habitat, they no longer have the ability to, or they no longer have the availability to use natural cavities. They have to use artificial houses provided by us. And so when those go away or people stop managing purple martin houses, unfortunately, they decline in numbers. And they're unable to use natural cavities. Well, one, there's just less. And then two is because of European starlings and house sparrows. Those are both invasive species that outcompete them for nests.
We will be visiting with Emma Rhodes, co-founder, director of conservation and scientific research for the Banding Coalition of the Americas, throughout the hour. If you have a bird question that Emma might could help you with, we might, though, have a couple of questions for Dr. Major on the line. At least the subject is cats, so let's go to Oxford. Anna is called in today. Good morning, Anna. You're on the air with us, so go ahead.
Hi. I live next to Avent Park. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And it seems that people dump their cats in Avent Park. We've taken one in because we are like a magnet. And we used to have three, and then she got so old. She was like 20 when she died. And then two other ones came along. One of them we've taken in. The other one vanished. And these are domesticated cats, okay? They know how to use the kitty litter, and they're just nice cats. And then the other day, we had another one come up, and she's absolutely gorgeous. She's like a hybrid white Siamese or cream Siamese, and she's desperate for a home. She just wants to... I guess my husband must be a magnet, or we're on the cat internet or something, because they just keep coming here. And you can't turn them away. And then one of the cats, which we had, which used to come a year ago, vanished. We thought, okay, so it's found a home. It came back yesterday. And I don't know if it's coming back to find out what's going on and pass the word or just what. But quite frankly, I've got two rescue dogs, and now I've got a rescue cat. I don't know if I can really have any more, and I'd love to find a home for this beautiful Siamese. She just is lovely. But, you know, what can I do? When winter comes, what are they going to do?
Dr.
Bain,
go ahead.
Yes. You know, this is a pressing question in many areas, and a lot of times, because of one reason or another, people will drop cats off in an area where they think, you know, somebody might adopt them. Do you have a local rescue agency there?
There is, we call her the cat lady. She goes over to the park and puts food down for there's a couple there. There used to be about 13 or 14 over there one time. I think the university students are getting ready to leave. I mean, you know, it's the spring break and everything else.
Right.
And so I guess they're going to be dumping a few cats. These cats that come up here, as I said, they're domesticated, and I hate to put them in a shelter. You know, to
understand.
Take them to the... Yeah, because they're so, I don't know, trusting. That's all I can say. And when winter comes...
It's a difficult situation, and as I said, it happens. It sounds like these are domesticated. They aren't feral cats, and you know, there's a difference between the two. And of course, sometimes when you're putting out food, though, you do attract feral cats as well, so there may be some issue with that. I would love to see you start some kind of little group or something of trying to, if you don't want to send them to a humane society, start a little group and try to advertise and place these cats, because you know your limits. You've got two rescue dogs and these cats, and you don't want to necessarily be called the old cat lady either. So I guess my point is maybe you can find some like-minded people in your area to develop a way to communicate with other people, maybe post online and try to place these cats rather than just having to turn them away or send them to the Humane Society.
Thanks for your call. And Dr. Major, I think that's a great idea, is that maybe, you know, find some like-minded folks in the Oxford area, and I think social media could certainly help out that, but kind of maybe getting the word out, and then others in the area that are willing to help out and take rescues will know that, you know, that where they can go to help things out.
Right. It's an ongoing problem, and a lot of times there are feral cats in the area. And, of course, we try to encourage people to, sometimes they have to be trapped with a live trap or humane trap, and have them at least spayed and neutered, which will help keep the population from going crazy. But it's a never-ending cycle. Okay, I guess that's the best way. And I really hate to see these cats, you know, be euthanized if we can find good homes for them, or just left to their own devices. So that's a great, and I really encourage her to continue her work, and hopefully she'll find some people that can help her.
Let's get one more call before our next break, and we go to Hattiesburg, and Bob has called in today. Good morning, Bob. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I have a two-part question. this is the first part. When we have some outside cats that never come inside, we have numerous bird feeders high and low outside. All types of birds come. But this is what, when a cat, that one of some of the cats is lay down to stalk these birds where they eat, and they lay there like a stone monument. They don't move, and eventually they'll catch a bird. I don't ever see them do it, but you find several feathers out there. This is a question. When they catch a bird, do they eat it? How would they eat the bird with the bones and the feathers and all that? After we see evidence of feathers, there's no evidence of any blood, bones, or partial eating of a bird or nothing. I just wondered if they actually eat these birds or what's going on. And the other part was...
Go ahead.
The other part was we also have a sheltered cat feeder with dry cat food in it. And the birds will land in it all the time, and all they do is pick up the dry cat food and scatter it all over the ground and the platform that the feed is on. And I just wonder if some of y'all could explain maybe the birds, the cats are trying to get it even with the birds or what. But these feeders are in different areas. And I'm going to listen off the air. Thank you.
All right, Bob, thanks for the call. Dr. Major, any thoughts?
You know, this is a problem, okay? And, you know, here in Jackson, we've had talks with the critter catcher and all that. And one of the things with the bird feeders in a lot of cases are strictly for the homeowner or whatever to be able to watch the birds, which certainly that's encouraged. But food dropping on the ground encourages rats, and that's one of the bigger problems in a lot of the areas. On the other hand, you're setting out attractive things for cats, and I have seen exactly what he's talking about. Cats will stalk and wait for a bird to come to the ground, and then they will catch it. In most cases, these cats are used to that, and they will eat the bird. They are able to consume that. I have had in my feeder a hawk before. They love to see the doves on the ground, and they will literally catch and consume a dove. But I suspect these cats are eating, and he didn't say whether they were feral or whether they were his cats or not. But having the cat feeder out like that also encourages other cats to come and participate. But I do feel like in a lot of cases, if you're not careful, you are setting up the birds for the cat to attack and probably consume the bird.
We'll continue visiting with our guest, Emma Rhodes, and we've got a couple of calls on the line as well. You're listening to Creature Comforts on MPB Think Radio. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Troy Major and Libby Hartfield. Our guest today is Emma Rhodes, co-founder and director of conservation and scientific research at the Banding Coalition of the Americas. So, Emma, we were talking earlier about purple martins. Does the BCA have current purple martin studies going on?
Yes, so we have a southeastern purple martin study that's been going on since 2021. So we're still pretty new to this, but we're working alongside purple martin landlords in several southeastern states, and also, you know, advocating and educating about, you know, why people should be purple martin landlords.
Do you have any events coming up that the public might be able to participate in?
Yes, we do. So April 6th through the 10th, we will be on Dolphin Island, and we're co-hosting an open to the public free banding event with Dolphin Island Bird Sanctuaries, and they conserve habitat for the birds. So we'll be banding on their property. And you should feel free to come check us out, and I encourage you to come check us out. So that's Dolphin Island, Alabama, and you can go to our website, bandingcoalition.org, and we have all that information posted. So that way you can figure out, you know, the details to that. So, but we would love to see you come to that event.
Libby, you had something that you wanted to bring up.
Oh, I guess I just wanted to mention one more time, that's a reason to find homes for those cats and get them indoors. particularly in the spring, it's really a good idea to keep your cats inside. bird eggs and newly hatched birds are going to be very vulnerable to cats. So anytime we can get cats inside, it's better for the cats and certainly better for the birds.
Speaking of feral cats, I believe that's what Megan, who's calling in from Jackson, wants to talk about. So, Megan, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Good morning. That's a good segue. So my point is, and this is a lot of discussion about feral cats, which really is a big problem, but I haven't heard any talk about spaying and neutering, which, warehousing or rescue is really not the answer. Spaying and neutering is really, and, you know, as far as the birds are concerned, I've read multiple sources that say that the feral cats are responsible for the death of about 1 billion birds a year. And is that accurate?
Anybody have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so feral cats, well, it's really outdoor cats. Unfortunately, the problem is that they're nonspecific hunters. So even if it's an outdoor cat and it's not hungry, you know, they're still going to hunt. It's just instinctual. And so it's not just birds. It's other native species, too. We are seeing, unfortunately, that's one of the primary causes of we say human impact decline of native fauna and flora is because of that predation. And so it is better, yeah, if you can, like if you have cats to keep them inside, obviously there's benefits too for your cat to be inside instead of being outside as well. But yes, that is true. There are many, many studies that show that you know, they are killing that many birds in North America annually. So it is problematic.
But Emma, you're right. As a former cat owner, you know, that is an instinctual thing. And even some of the play that we do with our cats is sort of mimicking what they would do when they're out hunting. So that's just kind of part of their DNA, I guess.
Yeah, and it is. And you know, I love cats too, but it's just something that they can't help, even if it's not, you know, and it's not necessarily that they're hungry. And one thing, when I used to work at a wildlife center that I think people don't realize is, even if they don't fatally injure the bird, the bacteria in cats' mouths is really fatal to birds. And so more often than not, even if there's a scratch on the bird, like with fledglings on the ground in the summer, even if your cat just puts that fledgling in its mouth, that fledgling, unfortunately, is probably going to die from bacterial infection. And so that's just something, you know, to stress the point of why you really need to try to avoid that, whatever you need to do, because they unfortunately, you know, more than likely won't survive even if they're not injured.
So I've got just a couple of minutes left. If you could, maybe if someone wanted to put up a Purple Martin house in their yard, maybe some tips on making it successful.
Yeah, so unfortunately, not every yard is going to produce or be good for Purple Martins. You really need somewhat of an open landscape. Not saying you can't have trees, but you need to have some sort of an adjacent field or open area. It doesn't have to be huge. But the problem is that, the reason I say this is because Purple Martins are like planes. So unlike other birds where they can just fly up, they sort of have to like glide, and they need areas to glide and forage for insects. So if you want to go to our website, we have some more resources, as well as there's some great resources out there on Facebook, Purple Martin Conservation Association and Purple Martin Fanatics. Those are both Facebook pages talking about how you can, you know, cheaply get started to see if you can attract Purple Martins by adding some artificial houses and what, you know, the do's and don'ts, as well as we can give you input based on your yard, whether or not, you know, you'll be successful in attracting the Purple Martins. But definitely encourage people to look at it, because everyone who I have met that has them really enjoys them in the summer months and gets to watch them raise their young and really get to be an integral part of their success. And I think that's why a lot of people do it, is because it's awesome to see these birds return year after year and successfully raise their babies.
All right, that is going to wrap us up for today. Creature Comforts is a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio, with funding provided in part by contributions from listeners. To hear today's show or a previous show, you can visit creaturecomforts.mpbonline.org. Our show is produced by Abram Nanny, and our call screener today was Charles Arnold. So for Dr. Troy Major, Libby Hartfield, and our guest Emma Rhodes, I'm Kevin Farrell, inviting you to stay tuned, because up next at 10, it's AutoCorrect. We'll be back next Thursday at 9 for another Creature Comforts, heard only on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.